Jay Rogoff has taught at Skidmore College since 1995, first in the former liberal studies program, and since 2001 in the English department, where he teaches courses in poetry, poetry writing, nonfiction writing, arts reviewing, and criticism, as well as Shakespeare and 20th century poetry. His new collection is Venera. It is Rogoff's fifth book. In it, a husband consoles his wife when she is wakened by an imaginary child. Another man daydreams of his kindergarten crush. Mary at the Annunciation, stunned by Gabriel's inhuman beauty, contemplates her decades of purity stretching ahead. Drawing on the natural world, personal intimacy and the imagination is evoked in visual art and biblical narrative. Rogoff's poems detail our drive to both acts of veneration and submission to Venus's sensuous power. And it's a pleasure always to welcome Jay Rogoff to our roundtable program. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I am great, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here. So thank you very much.
It's a delight to have you with us. I received this book several weeks ago, and so I read it several weeks ago. But it's a beautiful collection.
Oh, thank you.
How long? This is a very talk showy question, but let me ask what this is like of putting together a collection like this. It is a collection of your output, and yet it takes a long time to put together.
Yeah. Actually, some of these poems originated back in the 1990s, so some of them have been around for quite a while and have been revised again and again over the years. And in the interim, I've published a couple of books that actually were more recent work.
Right.
So some of this goes back a ways.
So when you have when does a title come into it of which I assume brings with it a theme?
Right. Well, the title came a little bit afterwards. I got interested in writing a slew of poems that had to do with love, and the second half of the book is a sonnet sequence.
Yes.
And I try in the sonnet sequence to play with these ideas of sacred and profane love, but also the tradition of sonnets, the idea that the beloved in a traditional sonnet sequence like Sidney's or Spencer's or even Shakespeare's at times is a kind of distant object, but also somebody with whom you can imagine getting down and dirty. So the name Venera I came up with as squinting in two directions. It suggests the root of words like veneration, but it also suggests words like venereal, things having to do with Venus, venery, the pursuit, the hunt. So the poems in that second half of the book generally try to mix the two of these in ways that are reflected in the language also, which is sometimes highfalutin, what we would think of as, quote, poetic, but also is sometimes really, really demotic and slangy.
How do you define for you of the sonnet and what you wanted to achieve? I mean, is this almost a challenge that you set upon yourself and say, I want to do this and these are the rules I'm setting for myself?
Yeah, I was working on a number of poems that have to do with love, and these are the poems that fill the first part of the book,
right.
The poems that have to do with parents and children, lovers and lovers, husbands and wives. And I decided that I wanted to write a poem about some of the imagery that I had seen in some Northern Renaissance paintings, specifically Jan van Eyck's Ghent altarpiece. And it's not that the poems are really about the paintings, it's that the images in them are kind of suggested by the paintings. What I ended up doing was writing a sonnet, and then I realized that it needed another sonnet and another sonnet. So it becomes like eating potato chips or something.
Right.
It's hard to stop.
And once you're in that mindset, right?
Yeah.
I mean, once you're in that sort of creative mindset, mm-hmm. then you think, oh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. You run with the sonnet. The thing about sonnets is that they're very challenging on the one hand. But on the other hand, if you sit down and write a sonnet, there's a lot of things you know about the poem right away. You know how long it's going to be. It's going to be 14 lines. You know more or less the structure, because sonnets traditionally divide into a first movement of 8 lines and a second movement of 6 lines. You know that there's going to be a rhyme scheme. You know that it's going to be an iambic pentameter. It doesn't quite become like filling in the blanks, but you have a kind of mental scheme for the poem that really helps you express what the poem needs to express.
It's as if you have a metronome.
Almost. Yes. Almost.
Yes. Almost. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned slang a moment ago. How does that come into this vernacular?
Well, I wanted the poems to be very romantic in a traditional sense, but I also wanted them to be undercut with contemporary language. So I wanted the two of those really working together. For example, I've got a poem, if I can point to one.
Please.
Yeah. It's one of the last poems in the book, and it's called The Table. And this is a poem in which I reimagine the Annunciation when the angel Gabriel comes to Mary to tell her that she's going to bear the Christ child. And I sneak the word dreck, okay, Yiddish slang for excrement, right, into the middle of the poem. So, The Table. The angel is in love with her. He wants to break his contract as the messenger. He wants to speak for himself. But what terror in choosing the dreck of human romance, to feel wing feathers scattered to the winds. Worse, to have to eat, to kneel at her altar, he who's never so much as tasted water, his airy gorge rising at those communions. The bread, not even bread, but always tasting like human flesh, the wine rich, disgusting as blood. Yet he'd eat at her board. He'd grow bones for her if he could encounter her by chance somewhere, a garden, say. Even he might offer her some food, some fruit or something.
Hmm. So there is a more, I don't know if casual was the word, but I guess that comes with the contemporary language.
Right, right. And so I also get into the poem phrases like he'd grow bones for her, you know,
yes.
This kind of sexually suggestive business of the angel choosing to become flesh and blood in order to pursue his desire for Mary.
How long does it come? Does it take you to come up with a term like airy gorge?
Ooh. Wow. They always seem spontaneous in retrospect.
Yeah. I mean, do you have to play with that, or does it sort of come? And because I've heard it described both ways, where mm-hmm. where writers and poets have said, you know, it comes to you, and then you just have to figure out where and when you're going to use it.
Yeah.
Or you know what you want, and then you have to play with it till you get what you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It happens both ways. There's a lot of push and pull. Another of the poems in the sequence has a line in it about a cellist, and this is a line that was suggested to me really at a breakfast. I was at a writer's colony for a while, and somebody came down to breakfast and just started talking about cellists and made some remark about how female cellists are always beautiful. Now, is that true? I don't think that's true necessarily, but it seemed to fit into this other poem that I was working on, because it did have this kind of highly unreasonable image of feminine beauty and desire for it. So it became part of this poem called The Mirror, and I played with the idea and came up with the line, "Speculation spreads like a cellist's knees." That's removed from the female beauty aspect, but it participates in the sexual business that I want going on in the poem.
When you have that moment and you think about it, and I know this is unrealistic to ask mm-hmm. you this, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Yeah.
Which is, what's the timeline? I mean, from the time that you have that discussion at the writer's retreat to the time where you work it in.
Yeah.
Like, how long is that?
Well, when you're at a writer's retreat, you're leaving breakfast and you're going to your studio and you
right.
work on it right away.
Okay.
So
it's immediate.
That line got into that poem that morning.
Yeah.
Yeah. The previous question that you had about airy gorge, phrases like that, this poem that I read, The Table, actually came to me very quickly. I probably wrote the first draft of that sonnet in about a half hour. And that's really unusual. Many of these I will labor on for weeks and weeks, if not months. The poem itself came very quickly, so I don't have a memory of exactly when a phrase like airy gorge came in, but I think it was just part of the process. I think it came along. But that sonnet was a gift, which is really fairly unusual.
I've heard, I've spoken to songwriters who will say that often it's, you know, your biggest hit often will be the one that took, you know, 10 minutes for you to write
right.
on the subway when you were coming home and you just jotted it down. But the ones that really mean something to you are the ones that you labor over, that,
mm-hmm.
that you were with for so long, that you have an attachment to, because they weren't. But I could see it both ways. One is a very natural and it just comes out of you, it pours out of you, where there's another one that you're literally in labor over.
Yeah, I mean, just because something comes quickly doesn't mean that it doesn't have value. Because you're writing your poem at the moment, but of course you've been preparing to write that poem for decades.
Yeah.
All of the reading that you've done, all of the writing that you've done previously. Somebody once asked John Guare, the playwright, how long it took him to write a play, and he said, well, for a playwright born in such and such date, it took me 60 years. You know, he was 60 years old at the time, right?
Well, and Tennessee Williams was famous for saying, okay, well, it's never done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was 40 when I wrote that. Now I'm 50 and I'm going to rewrite it.
Right. Right.
Because there's no finality to it.
Yeah. And there are poems that I've been laboring over for years. And sometimes as you labor over them, they get worse and worse. You know, there are some I'm still working on that I won't let see the light of day.
And don't you think that comes from just a test that you've set for yourself of it? It has to meet these standards. It doesn't. It's not working. It's not what I want.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes you're working on a poem and you realize it has to be something else. All right. In other words, not a story or an essay, but has to come in a different form. I might be writing a poem that's rhymed in couplets, let's say AABB, and it's not working. So what I might do is say, well, let's try this in free verse. Or if I have a number of words that are significant that are going to repeat in the poem, I might think, oh, darn, this is going to have to be a sestina and have those groups of six words that repeat every stanza. Or sometimes I will take the long line of the iambic pentameter and break it up. I'll just drop lines here and move lines there and put things out to the margin, you know, anything to play with it to try to get it to look like something new and to try to trick you into thinking that you're writing on you're doing something innovative.
As you mentioned, the book is really broken into two parts. Can you read something from the earlier section of the book?
Yeah, I'd love to. Let me read the title poem,
please,
of the first section. The two sections of the poem of the book, are "Only Child" and "Venera," the sonnet sequence. So this is the poem "Only Child." Situation: man and woman in bed at night. She's been awakened by something. Only child. A small child is standing at the bed. That's what you said. That's what you're saying as I shake off the shock of your voice rocking me awake. Then your eyes open and you chant this text. Can you remember what I said? Can you remember? You said, a small child is standing at the bed. Before that, before I woke, I think I asked, who are you? What's your name? Who are you? And then? I can't remember what will happen next. Something awful. Something terrible. That's why I wake. Something to the child? I can't remember. Hold me. You breathe deep. Talk of your daughter off at school. Your boy off with his father. Imagine, the only child to get you up at night for water is the small child of this visitation. Voice jingling like smashed glass. Hand dangling an eyeless bear. Our child. I cradle you, your back and bottom sweating in the dark. We breathe together, and the dark at my back cradles me.
Mm. Beautiful. Jay Rogoff reading from his new collection, Venera. I we're running out of time, and I have a million questions for you, but so we'll go into the lightning round. What is the I noticed this, and if this is not accurate, maybe it's just my ignorance. But it seems that in many of these poems, yes, certainly love and romance, but you also have there's a lot of geography. There's a lot of place.
Mm-hmm.
And is that more so than usual for you?
No. Well. One of the inspirations for my work is travel, and my wife is an art historian, which means that we
go all over.
Have to go to Europe a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, somebody's got to do it, and so I'll find myself in Italy or in Belgium or in France, and be in a place that's inspiring me historically, or in front of a work of art that I suddenly am so taken with, that I suddenly find so beautiful that I see possibilities in it for poetry. And as I said before, it's not always strictly what's called ekphrasis, that is writing about a painting. It's sometimes really just that there's a set of images there or feeling that I get from the poem that I want to capture. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask about, you know, you, because you, the Adirondacks or Carolina,
yes,
or Outer Banks, you know, of is there, so that's a place, a mood, and also, you know, more of a, almost an attitude, isn't it?
Yeah, some of the material is very close to home, very American, and I could read the Adirondack poem. Why don't we do that?
And with that.
Because that's near us, right. This is called Adirondack Scenic. And Wordsworth always wrote as if nature were performing for him, and so I kind of pick up the same idea. Adirondack Scenic. The blue-hung clouds dangle, a wavering curtain above the stage flat lake, as though a show were about to start. I have a good seat on the cabin porch. Off stage, a cardinal rehearses, some birds tune up, and from the trees, a wood thrush flutes an air like Debussy. Off stage, the loon begins an aria, a long note, carrying it out onto the water. A long note, and then it laughs. It can't recall if this is tragedy or opera buffa. Back and forth it shuttles, deciding, and before I can call you out to catch the ending of the second act, asbestos clouds ring down, and I run inside, battered with the applauding rain.
Jay Rogoff reading from his new collection, Venera, published by Louisiana State University Press, and that was Adirondack Scenic. Jay, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Congratulations on the new collection. A delight to have you share with us.
Joe, thank you, and thank you for having
always
me here.
Always a pleasure. Thank you. Coming up next, the Congressional Corner, you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.